Tap into the passion and vision of well-known entertainment luminaries with Thinking Out Loud. Go on a journey with unfiltered access to today's media innovators. Hear their strategy for rising above the crowded landscape. Important lessons and valuable wisdom that only comes from real industry experience.
Hello, I'm Vicki Lins, President and CEO of CTAM, a marketing organization focused on the media, entertainment, and technology industry. And today I'm speaking with co-founder and CEO of a global data and technology company called Spherix. Teresa Phillips is pioneering technology that's changing the future of entertainment, and we're really looking forward to talking to you about that today, Teresa.
Hi, thank you. Happy to be here.
I need to touch on some of your background because I have never met anyone who has your particular experience set. I mean, not only have you been named by Variety as a 2021 innovator to watch and Fast Company is in the next big thing in tech and one of Silicon Valley Business Journal's top women of influence, but going back farther, I'm actually going to read a segment from your bio because I don't think I will be as articulate as what is summarized here. And then we can dive into it and pull it apart. It says, Phillips' career began in the military as an executive assistant to four-star generals and diplomats, including two tours at the Pentagon and at NATO. The 5 years she spent supporting the Supreme Allied Commander Europe at the end of the Cold War was particularly pivotal in shaping your global market mindset, leadership style, and career. And I can't think of a more timely and topical conversation to have than coming from that particular place and bringing it forward into the industry at this particular point of time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's some days it seems like yesterday, even though it was some time ago, and other times it feels like I've had a very long career, but my military experience every single day has helped me, and I reflect on it in terms of leadership or strategy or the times that we see ourselves in today.
So first, just tell us, what's it really like to work at the Pentagon and at NATO?
It's exhilarating, and it's challenging. And remember, I worked in both of those places when I was very young, and I came from having grown up on a farm in Kansas. So I hadn't seen a whole lot. So everything to me was new. And I'm very observant and I like to experience new things. And so I love challenge. And that's how I managed to work for four-star generals, because I said, take me to the top. I'm willing to do whatever I need to do. It's eye-opening and it helps kind of accelerate your global thinking.
Just before we started recording today, you and I were talking a little bit about how remarkable it was that you spent years supporting the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, but just at the end of the Cold War and that initial phase of globalization. So talk a little bit about that for us.
At the end of the Cold War, I spent 5 years at Shape Belgium supporting General Galvin, who was the SACEUR, and then his successor, General Shalikashvili. And it was a very pivotal time in world history, you know, with the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, the reunification of Germany, the admission of Hungary and other countries into NATO, and then the formation of the European Union. So there was a lot going on. And not only that, but I, having worked at NATO and lived and worked with members of the NATO nations, we were able to see how gender and culture played out in very extreme circumstances. 30 years ago, with the Cold War ending and globalization taking root. And now we find ourselves later revisiting some of the same principles and concepts in terms of nationalism and populism and how do we support the movement of ideas and money and culture? How do we export culture? How do we produce products and services where it makes the most sense, but then still be able to share those with the world? And so I fear we're going in a different direction, but my kind of learning and starting out 30 years ago is it really helps me think about the future and helps me think about our company's strategy.
You just mentioned how culture plays out, and that's such a key part of what Spherix is doing. Why don't you talk to us about the company today and where you're headed?
Sure. I'll just add one other thing about the leadership aspect of the military, which helps as well. And that is, because I worked at the highest levels and worked for some amazing leaders, I was able to try on and see various styles played out in different situations and see what fits with me. And so most of my career, I haven't had to think about leadership because it's something that the military instills within you in terms of how do you assign and mobilize and align your teams? How do you delegate authority, responsibility, and accountability? How do you create a vision that people can own as their own and help people reach their full potential? So all those things that I take for granted, having come from the military, working with great people, a lot of people struggle with, they don't know. So I've been fortunate and able to carry out some of those things. And just to give you an example, my boss, General Galvin, used to say to me that great leaders don't seek to attract more followers. They seek to build more leaders. And so I've always tried to do that in my career. And I look back and think about all the people who've worked on my teams and where they are in their career. And I still get messages when they get promoted or when they have babies and do things. And I just feel so proud of that, that I've been part of other people's journeys and looking back.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about how gender played out in your career, especially being a young woman in the space that you were in.
The good thing is, because it's a large institution and it's rules-based and there's a code of self-responsibility and accountability. So there's not a lot of overt, and there is accountability with the system, but I don't know a single female that hadn't experienced some form of, whether it was just subconscious or conscious bias or harassment or sexual harassment even, including myself on a couple of different occasions. That actually prepared me, I think, too, in coming out to a world where there are no rules and where there's power that dictates people's positions. My perspective on gender is that the world isn't always kind to victims, right? We have a lot of power and we can use our power. And so we have strengths, and you just have to understand what your strengths are, and every situation, play to those strengths. Don't play to somebody else's strengths. And so I've never seen gender as kind of a detriment. I've always looked at it as my superpower, one of them.
That's a terrific insight, one that I happen to share and that has worked well in the course of my experience as well. And so hopefully some of our listeners will benefit from that insight as well. But I am going to shift gears now, because I think that what you're doing at Spherix is really interesting. And I want to tap into that with you. So first, tell us about Spherix so we can put some context around the conversation we're about to have for our listeners.
So Spherix, we support everybody in the ecosystem, from studios and networks to distributors and platforms, and helping them globalize their content, helping them culturally adapt it to meet certain compliance needs in countries where there is censorship, also help them classify it, age classify it, to provide local age ratings, and then just help them reach the broadest audience. So it's really about cultural adaptation of content for global distribution.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the international marketplace. What are you seeing with international content these days? You have such a terrific landscape view of the international marketplace.
So when you look at the global streaming platforms today, almost half of their revenue within a couple of years will be international. They have to produce content that meets the needs of those local customers, right? Consumers everywhere today expect that original programming is received day and date. And so that's a huge challenge. It's an amazing time with where we are. As far as where American companies are, Netflix is the furthest ahead. They are in a position to build the first global TV platform. Their strategy has been that they invest and produce content in regions and then try to make that content travel through the rest of the world. They haven't succeeded in that, but it's still very early. Other companies coming into this space, whether it's Amazon or Apple or Disney or Hulu, others, for the most part, they're still developing content that's being produced here in the US and distributing more broadly.
Let's talk a little bit about the dynamic between the localized content that resonates on a cultural basis versus the globalization of international content that crosses boundaries. You just mentioned Netflix hasn't yet been successful at their ultimate goal in this space, but they have seen tremendous success with some international programs going viral, so to speak. You know, Money Heist from Spain and Lupin from France, Stranger Things from the US have crossed boundaries and become global hits everywhere. But one could argue that that content isn't localized and customized and tailored to the markets that have embraced it. So could you talk a little bit about that yin and yang and the dynamic that exists in an effort to go global with it?
And Netflix has been successful. You're right. In fact, the two out of the top three programs have been produced internationally. So that's Squid Game and Money Heist, as you mentioned. And then Bridgerton is number two. So I believe that for the first month of Squid Game, they had 1.6 billion hours of viewing time worldwide. And Bridgerton was a distant second with about half that. And then Money Heist is third. So two out of three have been produced outside the US. It's the classic old age struggle between standardization and adaptation that goes back to advertising and every other product that is globalized or localized for international consumption. How do you take a global brand and then how do you localize the product, the packaging, or the messaging so that it resonates with local audiences? And other industries have done that through regional affiliates, local affiliates, whether it's food like McDonald's or Dunkin' Donuts or automotive or personal care products. They very much cater to the local audience. So just to give you a simple example, like take Crest toothpaste, for instance, same product. And when it's marketed to the US, which we are an individualistic society, it's marketed as Crest, white teeth, clean breath, guy gets girl, driving fast car, right? So it appeals to our individualistic culture. If you look at how they market that in the East, for instance, say Japan, it's the same product, the same packaging, but the messaging and the branding is Crest toothpaste, strong teeth, strong bones, strong family. Take care of your teeth, take care of your family. It's a collective society. There's a lot of different nuances in culture, whether it's power distance or ambiguity or communication or relationships and all these very important life events and tropes that play out across cultures. How other industries have done it is doing it regional. How theatrical has done it previously has been through adaptation of content where they've had months, if not years. Disney's a really good example. They do a great job at adaptation, cultural adaptation. A couple of examples there. One is Inside Out, where they substituted green peppers for broccoli because children in Japan and other countries, they like broccoli. And the character Riley was showing a disgust for broccoli, so they had to substitute it for green peppers. They've substituted animals in the movie Zootopia, also in a Marvel movie with, it was Winter Soldier in Captain America. They had the list of things that Captain America didn't see when he was frozen, and that list changed from country to country. But in the world of streaming, where we produce content in the matter of weeks and then syndicate that globally, again, day and day, it's not possible for them to do that. It's a lot of experimentation. Netflix tried that with Squid Game. They're in the press frequently because the subtitles are overtranslated or the meaning is lost. It is quite difficult, and there's no playbook today in how to do that. And that's really what the void that we're trying to step into and trying to imagine the future is, how can we bring culture forward? How can we help understand it so that it can be done consistently with timelines and still allow consumers worldwide to connect meaningfully with international programming?
And you're doing this using a combination of artificial intelligence, machine learning, your human resources. What does that look like? What is the Spherix approach to tackling this complex challenge?
So I think the first part of it is kind of a broader framework, right? So we spent years really understanding different regulatory environments from culture, political, all the legislation in every country. And we codified that knowledge and then we systematized it, well, we embedded it in our systems. And so we created this master playbook of scenes that are common in programming and how the world would interpret those scenes, everything from gestures to colors to food to relationships. So we look at, we call it cultural distance. So we look at the country of origin, which is where that title is produced, and then we look at where it's being distributed to. And then we look at all the cultural artifacts and events that are in the film or movie, and we say, how will that translate? How will that convey? It did start with cultural knowledge, and we've been able to build systems around that. And anytime you automate, obviously, you're simply automating a human algorithm. So the humans have to do it first. And we started with local age ratings, taking a title produced anywhere, and then being able to understand, again, those classifiable elements and the cultural aspects of it and figure out how that target country will interpret that.
What is that human input that sets this all in motion? What does that look like?
So the human input is we screen titles and we have two teams. One is focused on identifying and annotating the cultural events. And they don't know any rule of a country. They're content examiners and they're trained to recognize classifiable events. So for example, smoking isn't classifiable in the US. We don't care about it, but it is classifiable in say Turkey and India and the Middle East. There's a lot of examples like that. They understand cultural events. They understand how to annotate these. Context is everything in our business. So they look at a particular event and they think about everything around it. And that includes all these elements, whether it's violence, sexuality, nudity, cinematography. And then they capture it and they context it. And then it goes into the systems. And the systems then will interpret that on a large scale and apply it against rules. And there are people that are helping the systems as well. But those humans, over time, we've been able to take what the humans are doing and create training sets for our AI systems so that our AI systems can start to identify and understand the things that the humans have been able to do. And our AI system is unique in that because of the context, we use multimodal. So we individually evaluate the signals of the video itself, the audio track, and then the dialogue through closed caption. And our system will look at those independently, and then together it looks at them. So if there's some chopping, say chopping a knife, there's a knife and it's chopping. The computer vision aspect will say, that's not good. It's potential violence. But then the subtitles will realize there's dialogue, but they're chopping vegetables and not fingers, right? So those are examples of how we do it. So the idea is that we are over time training our machines to do what the humans can do.
Where do you see technology taking us next in this space?
We clearly have to use AI and machine learning in order to scale. And that's in the broad category of localization, globalization, localization, with so much content, $260 billion of spend in content just last year. It's just enormous amounts of content. It's the same set of translators. It's the same set of talent. We've reached the edges, right? So we have to use technology to automate. I think we have to change not just the use technology, but we have to change our processes. We have to change our methodologies, how we do things more broadly. What I think about and what we look to is how do we create platforms that apply this knowledge? And so that content ultimately is going to be created out in the regions because it is about local storytelling. And the world is fragmented with hundreds of languages. And so it's the local stories. If these global players want to compete, and they will and they do, they have to be able to produce content locally. And then make that story travel well, meaning make it not offensive, but make it very meaningful. And so we have to change the paradigm to say, we're going to start locally, but then we're going to go globally. And then we're going to go locally again. So the local aspect of it is producing the story and then understanding the writer's intent, understanding the themes, the trope, the super narrative, and then break that down, but do it globally. So we have a global master plan. Then it goes local again for the actual localization. That's where I think it's going.
Let's talk a little bit about content marketing versus content creation. In your earlier example about Crest, you were talking about the different ways that it's positioned in different markets to resonate with the culture and the audience there. Marketing content is really different than creating content and creating content that has a local culture embedded into it. Which is harder? And then how does the other component of it come into play when if you're looking at marketing content internationally that hasn't been customized, how challenging is it? And if you're looking at marketing content that has been customized, how challenging is it? What do you see your clients struggling with there or succeeding with there?
So you're right. They are different. In the product itself, say that the movie or the TV show, it does have a particular cultural DNA. And it can be kind of integrated or combined. Movies get produced in multiple places. They have cast from different countries, but it still has a cultural fingerprint. And I think it's less so about how do we localize, because localization largely has been about translation and some adaptation, but not a lot. It's mostly been translation to date. The bigger question, I think, is what do they want to do? There's this debate about maintain the integrity of the story and just storytelling, and who cares who listens and who cares if it gets censored. And every single day, there are tens of countries who are requesting edits to particular titles, everything from banning a title in the case of China's recently banned, Singapore, India, or suggesting that there are edits, otherwise they're going to be rated 18 or 21 in their territory, in which case they're going to be out of reach for their target audience. And so there's this real struggle between the creative talent and the business, say, what is it that we do change in order to meet the demands of the local market? And what can we change without sacrificing the integrity of the storyteller? So for the marketing aspects of these products, because they're digital distribution, it mostly comes in the way of personalization and search and discovery. And so people like Netflix are constantly on their network testing which artwork appeals, and they use taste communities, for example. And a lot of them are using unsupervised learning just to see what works where. The challenge with that is they don't know why it works. If they have a big enough data set and enough time and money, they'll figure out patterns of behavior, but they won't know why there are patterns of behavior. And that's where culture comes into play. So the packaging side of it in our space is really more about how do they personalize the experience for consumers and how do they help them find the content that they didn't know existed. And that problem, by the way, is going to be compounded with the rise of international content.
Finding the content becomes a really big challenge. And it's easy when Squid Games became this international phenomenon, it was easy for the audience to continue to grow because it had a lot of buzz around it pretty much everywhere. Getting there is a really different challenge. And I think to your point that tailoring the way it's positioned to gain traction and build meaningful momentum, a big hurdle to overcome. And I wonder, are you seeing or helping your clients identify the triggers to help make that happen?
Yes, that's correct. And that, in fact, is why people are investing more in serial content than they are single feature content. Because with serial content, and if you release it on a weekly basis, if you will, it develops a following and it allows the communities in the world to create a conversation around that. And then the anticipation grows. And so they become franchises and they support second and third seasons. And so it is really important that they develop ways in which they can leverage their audience and leverage the platform, because there is no loyalty in the digital space. It's so easy for people to churn off. And so what we're seeing is consumers will have one or two anchor, two or three, depending upon the market, anchor platforms or anchor services. And then they'll cycle through the others and they'll add in a couple of fast, one or two AVOD services to kind of complete their whole experience. And so the big guys are really focused on how do they become that number one or number two or three? And I think that's been the challenge with Netflix today, with what's happened, their subscriber. So churn is a problem today. It's a big challenge globally. And they're looking at ways they can become that one or two for everybody, and then they don't get cycled off.
Are you working with your clients to help them identify the triggers that will perhaps help a Bridgerton or a Squid Games gain traction in an international marketplace? Can you help with that type of insight, and how do they build meaningful momentum around that part of the equation?
So it is a challenge, and not just for the producers to distribute internationally. It's also a challenge for distributors who are licensing content that may have been previously exhibited in broadcast or other platforms in one or two markets, and now they're buying the licensing rights to distribute elsewhere. It's a challenge for platforms like Roku and others on the device side, the connected TV platforms, because they have to comply with the same laws that the producers have to comply with globally. And so a lot of what we help with, just for starters, is to understand what the local regulations are, which countries are censorship, which countries have explicit jurisdiction over the internet, which ones have active governance. So it's really about creating a risk model that's unique to the company based on their brand. Secondly, we help them understand the environment in which they operate in terms of specifications and standards, because it's very complicated to take one title and be able to deliver it globally in all these different markets and different languages with subtitles and dubs and things. It's very complicated. And so we help them unpack that to understand what's the minimal set that they have to do in terms of localization for the market and what's the optimal set. It's a business decision based on risk and budget and time and other things. And so then those that are further ahead that have been doing this and they've developed their global strategy, which we help with a lot, and then they now are distributing more broadly, then it becomes a matter of going from, say, hunting to harvesting, if you will, or gathering, so that we then help them increase engagement, reduce churn, better connect, reach a broader audience, and all those kind of things to make their content more appealing.
Let's dive into that a bit so that our audience really understands what SphereX does to make it easier for your clients to reach bigger audiences, generate more revenue. I think you're talking about the real importance of culture and content distribution. Break that apart for us a little bit.
Sure. So what happens is that, say, a title has been released in the US and it has an age rating. Let's say that it's a PG-13 rating. And it's PG-13 because it has some sexual promiscuity in it. And there might be an F word in it, or there might be some drugs in it. Who knows? But a lot of times, if people don't understand the international environment, they don't understand both the classification systems in every country, and more importantly, they don't understand what drives those age classifications, then they will tend to just map it. So they'll say, okay, if it's PG-13 here, let me make it age 14 in Germany and make it 15 in the UK, and they'll just make it up without knowing. Or they just say, I'm not going to guess because it's too big of a risk, and so I'm not going to rate it, and then it becomes not rated or unrated. So any one of those paths are potentially problematic. One is that if they assume that, so for countries that have a real high tolerance, for instance, or they don't even classify, say, nudity or sexuality, as in most of Europe, they're basically rating it too high. And so they're going to map it across age 15, when in fact, if you were to apply the local standards, it would be age 9 or age 10, because those countries don't care about it. And the culture is not that big of a deal. And in any of these countries, if you're mismapping a title and you're being conservative about it and you're just mapping it to say 16, the difference between, say, 12 and 16 or 11 and 15 is millions and millions of youth. And in these countries, there are laws that prohibit parents from actually allowing their kids to screen content if it's not suitable for them. So it's not like in the US where your kids just drop them off at the movie theater and or they can watch whatever they want. Most countries have laws around that. And so that's one issue where they're missing their target audience. The inverse is also true in that we are very desensitized to violence in our film and television. And most countries are a lot more sensitive to that. And so if we map something, say PG-13, and we just map it, in a lot of countries, it would be age 16. And then they're at risk. They're at jeopardy of having a lower age rating. And then that content could be presented to youth who are searching. And then they can be in legal jeopardy in that country. And then also, if it's unrated or not rated, it's not going to show up anywhere, because these platforms in search and discovery, if they don't know the age rating, they have no idea. There's no signal for them to know the audience suitability of that content. So customers will never discover it. So those are kind of the three scenarios of the risks involved if you don't know what you're doing culturally and how it plays out.
Earlier, you made the comment that context is everything in our business. And the context that you're working in is changing for every piece of content that you touch. What does the scope and scale of SphereX's work look like? And how do you begin to manage a client's library if it's vast?
So you're right, it does change frequently. And the laws are slower to change than some of the interpretation of the laws, if you will. So what that means is, there's the letter of the law and the spirit of the law in most countries. The letter of the law tends to change a lot slower, but these regulatory bodies will use all kinds of obscure clauses to censor or to condemn content. And so our first line of defense is relationships with the regulators. So we have spent years developing active relationships. We attempt to be a part of the process in terms of evaluating proposed legislation. We provide feedback on it, so that we kind of become this proxy for how American companies will be able to implement these changes, what the perception will be. And again, it takes usually 12 to 18 months. We work with countries in submitting our technology for approval so that we can rate on their behalf. In fact, we can do this if they're not able to do it for whatever reason, because of volume or because of lack of explicit jurisdiction or other reasons why they can't do it. We can then become a proxy that they can refer people to us to do this. So it does change frequently, and we maintain close relationships with regulators. We also have a team of people that are looking at the regulatory markets and being able to figure out, you know, what are the enforcement actions, and then how do we interpret and develop those as rules and then get them in our system so that by the time that it comes to market, a change comes to market, we're already prepared.
So what do the skill sets look like that are on the Spherix team? What kind of experience are people bringing to your team that allows you to cover such a broad spectrum of opportunity in this space?
So we have a number of different disciplines, from our content examiners who require critical thinking skills and be able to dissect content and look at it through a specific lens. We have country experts who get their feed from policy analysts. So we have a lot of legal and policy analysts who are constantly looking at the international spaces. And then the country experts are the ones who then take that and interpret it. We have obviously AI and ML engineers that are experts in voice or audio or NLP, computer vision or NLP, that can help us build these. And then the last one is data, because we do maintain a 20 million title set, a database of 20 million titles, plus all their various versions and incarnations. And that is how we're able to quickly derive ratings and make some adaptations in content that's already been distributed. So I haven't talked about that yet, but to your point, there's so much content. How do you do it with customers have such large catalogs? So one situation is when a customer will have, say it's a television network that will have tens of thousands of titles that they've syndicated to, say, Canada and the US, and now they want to go to the UK and Australia or Brazil and Mexico or lots of places. And so what we do there, it's not, obviously it's not time or cost prohibitive. It's not practical for us to manually screen it or even to have our AI engine just do it alone. So we use market signals and we go out to the markets where the title has been exhibited. And we look at everything about that title, whether it's might be a local rating or community feedback or other groups that are reviewing or rating that title. And then we're able to then bring all that data in-house and apply our algorithms to it. So then we can understand, using signals, we can understand what really is in the title. What are some of the kind of the intensity and the frequency and the intensity and the strength of some of the elements like violence and things? Is there blood? Is there violence? And then we're able to derive the rating using our algorithms. So that's how we're able to scale. But the team is definitely multidisciplinary. We have a pretty tight group of people and methodology and how we do it so that nothing falls in the cracks.
How do you see all of this playing out in the streaming wars? Netflix was out ahead. They're getting beaten up a little bit now. We've got Warner Brothers Discovery with David Zaslav saying that he envisions one large streaming service. Apple's been gaining traction. Obviously, Prime and Hulu are out there. You've got a lot of big players competing in this international space and a lot of smaller ones as well. So how do you see this playing out over the next year to two in the immediate future?
I think it's definitely going to be a winner-takes-all market. As we've seen, there's kind of a big blip with COVID and how consumers' entertainment budgets were allocated to streaming. And now that's much less so. And also we're seeing churn is becoming an increasing problem with more and more choice available. And discovery is a big issue. And content is undifferentiated. And what's interesting to me is that we're starting to see how the strategies of each of these players is very much in line with their brand. And so you look at Netflix, for instance, who was out ahead, and others have been the beneficiary of Netflix's learnings in the marketplace. Several years of learnings and hitting up against brick walls in these countries and trying different things and using data to do so. At some point, because I think they were looking over their shoulder, they sacrificed quality for quantity. And as they started to lose some of these licensing agreements where Disney and others pulled back and they didn't have that deep catalog of content that they needed, they knew that they needed to have when you're going out to offer a global service with all these different audience segments, they had to have depth in catalogs, or they sacrificed the quality for quantity. And we're starting to see that now. You take Apple, on the other hand, which they were the first one to get an Oscar this year with Kodak, and they've only been doing it, what, a couple of years? And so we don't hear about them also in encountering brand issues in the marketplace because they are so focused on their brand. They know exactly who they are. I think they've done a curation from curating content very much in line with their brand. Disney, I think, is going to have a problem or a challenge rather with how are they going to evolve their brand internationally to be able to have some more mature content from, say, Fox or Marvel or others when their brand is so aligned with children's programming. So how do we see that branding evolve in the marketplace? And Amazon, of course, has a lead like Netflix. In the case of India, for instance, where Disney did come in and buy Hotstar and kind of pay to play there and are almost double number of subs, they still have invested quite a lot. So they've really taken a real local approach in some key markets to kind of build that out, but they also have their commerce as a backdrop. So all of these players, with the exception of Netflix, have some other core business that they're subsidizing with this content. But again, it goes back to, we all have 24 hours in a day, and you look at the different audience segments who are streaming, and you look at the movement to FAST and AVOD and how the advertisers are moving off of broadcast into FAST and AVOD. So that is becoming more popular. You look at TikTok and other short form players that are consuming the younger generation's time, as well as international markets, especially in the East. They're Korea and other places. These platforms are very, very popular. There's a lot of competition for people's time. And the name of the game is to figure out how to become that one or two, how to develop that relationship with the consumer so that you can understand their behaviors, you can develop personalized content, and you can build a connection. And so there are going to be players that don't have that access because, especially if you look at Europe, the thing that they've contributed, I think, the most is regulation around privacy and other aspects. And so these platforms in Europe don't share the data. And consumer data is absolutely essential for competition. If producers don't have access, I think we'll see consolidation there. For instance, they'll buy a Roku or they'll buy another point of presence that has the access, a piece of it.
All very interesting observations and insights. And you said earlier, there's no loyalty in the digital space. So the one thing we know for sure is that consumers are going to be making very different choices and moving around and configuring their media entertainment ecosystems in very customized and different ways. So it's going to be a fascinating journey to see where we all go with this.
Yes, certainly. And I think the company that can first figure out how to produce content and produce local stories, and then on a global basis, figure out the strategy for how that content then again gets localized. So go from local to global to local. They can do that in the most efficient way. We'll win ultimately.
Well, and SphereX is perfectly positioned to help shepherd them through the myriad of challenges that exist with that. And I so appreciate you taking time to speak with us today and walk us through so much of this.
Thank you, Vicki. It's been a real pleasure.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.